Yes, so talking about the kinds of industrial action that took place during the ancillary workers dispute, Jim.
Well, in 1973, certainly locally, there was not a great deal of activity, really. We had our outdoor meetings, we organised petitions, we had pickets of a kind, the gates to the hospital, whereby we stopped, well, not stopped people coming in, but halted them to give them information on the dispute and ask them to sign petitions, that kind of thing. Nothing serious at all. Here again, then, it looked much worse than what it actually was. Because let's face it, when you're working in a hospital, I do believe when it comes to industrial action, one has to count up to 10 and possibly even up to 20 before you take an action, because of the very nature of the job itself. I've got some very fixed views on industrial action in all types of industry, which I think should apply to all industry, but certainly to the National Health Service, because of the very nature of the job we do. And these views, well, one may call them principles, have been highlighted, I think, by what happened over the last winter. Was it Jim Callaghan who called it the winter of our discontent? Well, actually, last winter was not as bad as what some people think. We know there were a great number of people involved, but in terms of actually hitting production and halting production, there was only the lorry drivers who made any really kind of impact. The rest was really numbers involved and a little bit of inconvenience and discomfort to the public at large. You know, the hospital porters, incinerated people, the dustbin men. It made life a little bit unpleasant. But as regards halting production, affecting the index of industrial output, was negligible.
What happened here, during?
Here, I don't think anything happened.
Nothing at all happened?
Nothing at all happened.
Well, not even there was no action at all?
We had the odd meeting to keep people in the picture, but my members certainly just did not want to take any action whatsoever.
What about the NUPI members, though? Did they take
the NUPI members,
longer action?
I think they were overruled by the feelings of their own members. They didn't want to take any action either.
So it was quite quiet?
So very, very quiet. All around us, there's all kinds of industrial action round about in the district, in the country at large, of course, but here, nothing whatsoever. All that happened here was we were affected by the action of people in other hospitals. For instance, the laundry now, it's an area laundry, which processes the patient's laundry for a number of hospitals.
Yeah. Where is that situated?
This is situated at the Sunderland General Hospital.
Yeah.
So, of course, when they were taking action, which meant very often a reduction in returns of articles of clothing, bed linen, etc., sometimes a complete halt for quite a length of time. This, of course, cost the health service money insofar as a lot of stuff rotted away and has to be replaced, particularly soiled bed linen, that kind of thing. But this was action outside of the hospital itself. Inside the hospital, action was none.
None at all. Yeah. Yeah.
But to go on from what I was saying earlier, as I say, during the winter, the only people who made really impact on the economy were the lorry drivers. And I was thinking, even the lorry drivers themselves, at the end of the day, when they got their pay rise through, they were complaining that they lost the money that they had lost during the strike. In other words, they were saying they could never make up the money they had lost. In other words, what's the point of taking industrial action if you're going to be worse off at the end of the day than what you were at the beginning?
So, in general, you don't really approve of industrial action, Jim?
I firmly believe that the only action which can be of benefit to members of any organisation in any industry or service is one whereby the action is short and swift. Because if the action drags on, or, particularly where the strike action is involved, where people are losing their wages, it takes only a matter of a few weeks whereby they reach what one may call the point of no return, where you've lost so much money, It will never be made up by whatever wage award you win. Another thing I have in mind is the Ford workers who took industrial action before the expiry of their current agreement. Mm-hmm. Now this again, to me, implies a very bad morality. Mm. If one makes an agreement, I mean, what do the Ford workers say if they had an agreement with the management broke? Mm. I think all hell would be let loose. Yet they themselves blithely took industrial action before the expiry of the existing agreement.
Yeah.
Which this to me puts trade union negotiations in a very, very bad light indeed.
What do you think of such actions as occurred at places like Brooklands or so on, where they had a working at the psychiatric hospital and where they excluded higher administration from the wards and things like this? I mean, there are other forms of industrial action that people can take apart from striking, isn't there?
It's strange that each hospital seems to have its own forte when it comes to industrial action. I think that what happens is they choose the weapon they think best suited to their own particular needs. How this comes about, I don't know. Maybe the location of the particular hospital, maybe even the historical antecedents of that particular hospital, what's ever happened in the past. You may have tried one thing and say, well, we'll try something else this time. You know, this kind of thing can go on. I suppose work in is as good as as effective as any other particular kind of action. Mm. I suppose when they're working in, at least they are working, which is totally different to somebody who works out and doesn't work at all.
What kinds of issues come up on a day-to-day basis, do you think? What kinds of typical issues do you find you deal with as a branch secretary? I mean, for example, at the moment.
Well, one often gets queries rather than any kind of dispute. Mm. The management here, certainly as far as the Confederation is concerned, all of them except two, this is the nursing management I'm talking about, all except two are members of the Confederation. And as such are bound by Confederation principles, practice and rules. Mm. Therefore, we have a very good working relationship with the nursing management. This, of course, is one of the things that Newby jumped on when they started their activities, that we were associated with management, so we were management men. See? But to come back to the day-to-day disputes, most are things which can be ironed out with the management in a matter of minutes, one might say. They normally revolve around questions of days off. Have they had their correct pay? Have they had the correct holidays? Matters of very minor importance, really. No doubt important to the people concerned, but as a union, something that they've been taken in our stride.
Mm. So what, usually just requires a phone call or something?
A phone call, more often than not, settles the whole matter.
So it's a lot of individual problems.
Individual problems, yes.
Somebody thinks a pay packet is short or something.
That's
like
right.
That.
As regards other union business, most of this can be taken care of at branch meetings, where people can be put in the picture, so what's happening not only locally but nationally as well. In between branch meetings, we have circulars we can put out to inform people what is going on as regards wages, conditions and what have you. But no problems.
Do you have stewards?
We have stewards. Here, we prefer to retain our old title of committee. So they are stewards, they have their official stewards cards, but we still refer to ourselves as being members of the Confederation Committee.
What grades of staff are on the committee? Can you just
Through it? All grades, of course, are eligible, of course they're all members, mostly nursing staff. At the moment we have one domestic, one van driver, and one, I think, he's a semi-skilled engineer, which is and the rest nursing staff, which is the biggest spread of grades of staff that ever we've had since I've been here.
How many nurses on the committee then? roughly? I mean, just approximate.
6. Mm. You commit yourself with a number about 10.
And do they take up issues as stewards in, as individuals in the department?
More often than not, they refer matters to me.
Ah, so you, yes, so that they yes. pass it on.
I've no doubt they're all capable men. They could all deal with these questions themselves if they so wished. But for some strange reason, they always give me a phone call and tell me and I do it. In my absence, if it happens to be my day off or holidays, the branch chairman, they get in touch with him, and he's just the same as me, he just deals with it.
Mm. So it's sort of recognised that it's the branch secretary that works through management to take up an issue?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I see. And you said relations are good with the local nursing management. Mm-hmm. How about the management at district level? And
we've had our moments with the area. We don't have a district here.
It's a
single district area health authority. Mm-hmm. As opposed to places like Durham where you might have 3 or 4 districts.
Well, is it Sunderland area health?
It's the Sunderland area health authority. And we've had our moments with those in the past. Fortunately, since then, things have improved. And we're on fairly good terms now.
What kinds of things
come up? I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think so much. No, I couldn't offhand, no.
No, but is it a feeling that generally they're rather remote and
we've had the gloves off on one or two issues. Mm. I was trying to think what the issues were now. I think it'd been more on the side of the management themselves rather than from us.
Mm. Never mind, it doesn't matter too much, but it's just an interesting... Mm. Interesting issue. Would you say most of the amount of business is to do with ancillary workers or nurses? What would you say?
Oh, it's roughly 50-50 comeback.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there a bonus scheme here for the ancillary workers?
There are some grades, more of the craftsmen who run bonuses at the moment, mm-hmm. electricians, that kind of thing. The vast majority of ancillary staff here are not on bonus schemes as yet. Mm. Most of them have been work studied and we're waiting for the final report from the work study team. Mm. And then of course there will be a final meeting with the union representatives to iron out the problems. Yeah. There ought to have been a bonus scheme here years ago. When the bonus schemes were first introduced in hospitals, they were always a bit of a contract to me. I think, if I remember rightly, it arose out of a white paper in 1962. And the bonus schemes in hospitals were designed to try and get over the problem of the low-paid worker. Mm. And so these bonus schemes were introduced as being self-financing bonus schemes. In other words, whatever money was given to the staff by way of bonuses had to be recouped by virtue of not replacing people as they left, that kind of thing. Mm. In other words, the group of workers concerned had to pay themselves by working with fewer people than what they originally started with. Mm. However, it never quite works that way with these schemes. And one invariably finds there are as many people working at the end of the day as what they were at the beginning. Certainly that's my experience here and of what I've heard of other hospitals. Possibly because the base point as regard numbers with domestics and ancillary staffs has been lower. And so we've had the bonus schemes introduced at a time when the hospitals are needing more and more porters and domestics. Mm. But as I say, there is no bonus scheme here now for porters, domestics, kitchen staff. But there ought to have been one. We should have been one of the first in the country to have had a bonus scheme. Because when this first came out, the white paper was 1962, it must have been around about 1964, when I called a mass meeting of all staff in the hall to put to them the concept of a bonus scheme. The bonus scheme was turned down. It was turned down primarily not because the members didn't want a bonus scheme, well, because the maids were under pressure from their domestic supervisor not to accept the bonus scheme.
Why?
I think she had her own reasons, rightly or wrongly, but she was certainly making sort of like threatening noises off stage not to accept the bonus scheme. There was certain staff here at that time, notably the van drivers, who didn't want the bonus scheme. Now here's what I sort of meant when I told you earlier that one has to be very careful because of making libelous statements. The van men didn't want a bonus scheme, and one of the van drivers at that time was most vociferous and most instrumental in having the bonus scheme turned down. It was because they had certain perks, you might say, in the way of being able to service cars at their station in the hospital. So obviously they didn't want a work story team nosing around the garage where the vans and that are and find them doing private work.
Well, as I said, there's no need to mention any names. But
yes.
I believe there's been similar troubles with Dustman and Totting, actually.
A similar thing, yes. One of the perks of the job.
So the fear is that bonuses would do away with perks. So in fact, they wouldn't improve your salary at all. You'd be worse off at the end of the day under a bonus scheme because you'd lose out on other...
Some people who had these perks would obviously lose out. Mm. The majority of people would have more money in their pocket.
Mm. But some
Ryhope General Hospital, they have a bonus scheme, the domestics.
Yeah.
Now you see, they are having a few pounds a week more than people up here who are working no less hard than what they are doing down there.
They're working just as hard up here?
They're working just as hard up here. Some of these wards up here can be very, very hard indeed. Mm. They're very large wards and a different type of work to a domestic in a general hospital.
Yeah. In what way is it different?
Well, in a general hospital, for example, you can have a number of wards where the patients are in bed all day.
Mm.
Or if they're not in bed, they're up sitting around in chairs in a dressing gown.
Mm.
See, and that is it. In a mental hospital, you have people who are on the go almost all the time. They live here.
Mm.
They're not here just for a certain kind of treatment and then discharged. By and large, they are here for the rest of their lives. This is their home.
Mm.
And as their home, they are free to come and go as they wish. So you can have a ward maid who has done, as part of her duties, washed a corridor.
Mm.
The corridor is hardly dry when these fellas can come tramping in.
Yeah.
Over a clean floor.
It makes the job harder.
And this goes through the whole business.
Mm.
They in and out of the kitchen make themselves cups of tea or cups of coffee or a sandwich.
Mm.
They in and out of the dormitory to the lockers and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we see it's a very mobile kind of atmosphere as compared with a general hospital.
Yeah.
Where the patients are, by and large, static.
Mm. What kinds of area are the nurses recruited from? Are they mainly local or
they are mainly local.
Yeah.
Ryhope, which is where the hospital is situated, Sunderland, Seaham, Hortonleigh Spring, Penshaw, Peterlee. That is more or less the boundaries of where the bulk of people come from. But of course we do have people apply from other parts of the country. And of course are accepted. And occasionally, of course, we do have our overseas friends who come occasionally.
But not very many.
But not in Maine. Not to the extent that you find them in the Midlands and the South.
Yeah. Mm. Is this because of it being a depressed area, the jobs have been taken from people, that people have left sort of mining and other industries that have been declining and then come into the
I've never seen any kind of tie-up between the hospital recruitment and the generally depressed area that you mention. In the earlier days of the hospital, if one takes, say, the 1930s, then you did have an awful lot of people came into this hospital from the mines and the shipyards.
Is that right?
Yes. Because this was the only kind of job they could obtain.
Mm.
And as I say, in those days, it was a big help if you could play the trombone or the piano or the big bass drum. Or a footballer or a cricketer.
Yeah.
That was a very big advantage into getting a job here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily any academic standards or intelligence. Of course, those since then, of course, with the development of nursing and these in the psychiatric field, particularly, the General Nursing Council have set standards that people have to obtain, as you know, to entrance qualifications.
So you don't, it's not your impression that there are a lot of people have come in the 60s?
Not because of the kind of a job elsewhere. Not because of that. Mm. I think the people who are coming in now are people, if you weren't coming in here, I doubt if they would be going into the mines or into the shipyards.
Mm. But presumably there are limited opportunities for school leavers and
very limited
18-year-olds in this area.
Very limited around here. Which is one of the reasons why I was most upset about the phasing out of the cadet scheme. Mm. Because what has happened since then, and this is surprisingly enough, with the cutbacks in the National Health Service, our training programs have been affected. At one time, we had three training schools in the year, one starting in February, one starting in June, one starting in October. Now there are only two training schools. Mm. And they're having the utmost difficulty in filling those two schools.
Are they? Mm. They're not finding recruits? Not finding
the recruits. But with cadets, we had a ready-made source.
Oh, because there's this gap between 16 and 18.
Because of the gap. You see, people leave school now. If they get a job at 16, no doubt they'd like to come into nursing. The earliest they can come in is 18. Mm. By then, they've usually found a job. And then they look at the salaries they could get in nursing and they say, well, I have more than that now. Mm. So why should they come into nursing?
Yeah. Yeah. So how else, I mean, you were talking about the cutbacks, how else have the cutbacks affected, say, you know, the shortages of things and affected the nurses in their job and made their job more difficult?
It's difficult to estimate. I think what strikes one really is the small, irritating things you can meet. Mm. There's no doubt the cutbacks have a depressing effect on salaries. Mm. The nursing staffs got a very large increase in salaries in 1974. They all got increases ranging up to almost 50% of salaries. Mm. Of course, I realise in hindsight, that other industries and professions at that time were in a very inflationary period. We were also getting large increases. So our increase wasn't as big as it appeared to be at that time. Mm. Certainly it did give a tremendous lift, but very soon prices and everything caught up, and now we are right back to the 74 situation almost. Mm. Yes. I think if for instance, this comparability study, which is currently being undertaken by Professor Clegg, if nothing comes out of that, or if something comes out of it which the new government is looking to implement, then we will certainly be in the pre-1974 situation.
Mm. And would you review your attitudes about industrial action then?
This will have to be reviewed then, of course. Yeah. Now, I've no doubt head office and the National Executive Committee will be keeping an eye on this kind of thing. At least I hope they are. Yeah. If they're not, I'll soon tell them.
Mm. But how do cutbacks affect you on the wards on a day-to-day basis? I mean, what kind
well,
of things are you
the cutbacks, of course, is something that only takes effect really over a long period. Mm. You find the hospital cannot continue with a proper level of maintenance. They can't continue with having adequate supplies, we'll say, of clothing. They can't plan for a new ward, which is badly needed, what we term a decanting ward. Mm. That is where patients can go to while the ward is being decorated. Mm. All kinds of building programs can be halted.
How about sort of supplies of things like sugar and provisions? And is that affected at all?
Well, the catering department is allotted a certain sum of money per head of patient, I understand, and it's a very minimum. This is not to say that patients are underfed or anything like that, quite the contrary, they're very well fed. But things are kept to a minimum insofar as possible. And I've no doubt the curating officer has very great difficulty in meeting his commitments.
So, is there a danger, do you think? You're talking about these improvements that occurred in the 60s and so on. Do you think they are being eroded or not at the present time by the cutbacks?
Well, not here. But of course, I couldn't really say offhand without giving a great deal of thought as to what the effect will be in a few years' time. The standard at the moment in this hospital is extremely high, much higher than you'll find in quite a lot of similar mental hospitals. Both staff-wise, in numbers of staff, in the quality of the staff, in the conditions for both patient and staff, this hospital will be very hard to beat. I'm convinced that a few years ago here, we introduced the grade of enrolled nurse. Prior to that, we'd always had student, staff nurse, charge nurse. Then they introduced the pupil nurse, which led to the enrolled nurse. Now, the enrolled nurse, but in terms of examinations, is well below examinations as set for staff nurses. And I'm sure the reason for this is that in other parts of the country, such as the Midlands and the South, there are so many foreign students, Spanish, West Indian, what have you, who have certainly initially great language problems, that the paper set for the enrolled nurse is put at such a low standard to take account of these people. Because I'm sure the enrolled nurse paper is laughable, really.
Yeah, so there are more, and that's obviously one way in which they're economising on staff. Presumably, are they?
Well, it is a dilution of staff. If you have the majority of staff who are qualified, insofar as you have so many charges, so many staff nurses, and then you introduce a large number of enrolled nurses, then obviously there has been a dilution of staff. Coupled with that, at Cherry Knoll, over the last few years, we've had a tremendous number of nursing assistants employed, which again has further diluted staff. Now, I know there were problems insofar as we had extra holidays arising from Holsbury. We've had numbers of wards that never used to have night staff on them.
And so wards here that didn't used to have night staff?
No. This one was one. There was never anybody here during the night.
Really?
And of course, with the all the publicity, or bad publicity, we've had regarding fires that arising from the disquiet of the management, plus recommendations from the fire department, this kind of thing, they've had to employ these people as nursing assistants to come onto wards where there were previously no staff, primarily as fire watchers. So
well,
here,
no, I would like just, you know, a ward like this hasn't got any incontinent patients or anything
no,
like that.
No,
it's.
But there must be about six to eight wards like this that never formally had night staff, but do have them now.
Not well, even as late as a couple of years ago, there are wards in wards without night staff at all. I mean, how recent?
No, this goes back certainly 74 onwards.
Quite
as recently as that, yes. We had 7 or 8 wards where there were no night staff.
Turning to sort of the National Union, do you find, you indicated to me that sometimes you act as a bit of a ginger group at national level, is that right? That you try and sort of be forward resolutions commonly to the NEC?
Well, we haven't done that. I fully understand, of course, that any branch can affect national policy by virtue of saying resolutions fall from here to the Regional Council. If accepted there, go from the Regional Council to the National Executive Committee. This, of course, is in between delegate conferences.
Yeah.
At a delegate conference, of course, a branch can send a resolution direct to the National Executive Committee. This is drawing up and put on the agenda for the National Delegate Conference. In my time here, no one has ever put forward a resolution, which is disappointing. It could show either a lack of interest, a lack of knowledge of procedure, I don't know. But certainly they never dream about doing it. This year, I'm thinking, I've been so upset by this sort of lack of interest here, that I'm considering this year going to a delegate conference with express intention of going on the rostrum on some occasions from the agenda.
Do people send forward resolutions to the regional council?
We haven't even sent resolution to the regional council.
What kinds of things?
But at the regional council, I often raise things myself there draw people's attention to various things or what have you. And of course, as being on the regional council, we can send resolutions as a regional councillor to the national executive also.
What kinds of business come up at regional councils?
Not as much as I would like to see. I don't think the regional council act in as businesslike a manner as I would wish. A large part of the time is taken up by going through previous minutes. For example, the regional council now only meets twice a year, as opposed to four times a year previously. But the regional executive committee now meets four times a year, as opposed to twice previously.
So the parish.
So it is the national executive. It is the regional executive committee, which is doing work, or a lot of the work that formerly was done by the regional council. So what you have really is you go there, you go through the minutes of the previous regional council, the minutes of the previous regional executive committee, possibly the minutes of the previous national executive committee, and go through that any question that may be arise that can be explained by either by some member present, by a national executive committee member, or by a regional secretary. This correspondence comes up, which usually all branch secretaries have in any case, because the regional secretary, more often than not, only gets correspondence that we receive as secretaries. We have a report of the regional secretaries regarding membership, what cases they've taken up, and all this kind of thing. But with regards to formulating policies, there's very little done to my way of thinking. I do think more could be done on those lines, looking at the problems that various hospitals have and trying to help as a regional executive committee.
So they're largely jamborees, are they, do you think? Or is that
a
fair
thing to call them
or not?
No. People go to these executive committee meetings every other month, sometimes a great inconvenience, but I don't know exactly how to put the point over, that I don't think they're doing the work that they ought to be doing, insofar as trying to publicise the union, bringing up matters on wages, in other words, general information that the members could possibly find of use.
So you think they could have a bigger role in?
I think they could. I definitely think they could have.
Is there any other ways in which you think the union could be changed to improve its structure?
Well, structure-wise, I think it's first class. There's a very good channel of communication right from branch level right up to national executive committee level. And even personal contact with general secretaries, where the branch secretary is fairly well known, if it comes to a push. No, structure-wise, there's no problems there. I think if any problems arise, it lies in the sort of conflict one may have between being a member of a union and also being a professional person. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, the Confederation advertises itself as being a professional trade union. And I do think there is a conflict here between being a member, albeit a professional trade union, at the same time being a professional. In other words, the union has all the rights of any other union which is affiliated to the TUC, that is, the rights to negotiate wages and conditions, the right in the last resort to go on strike. And yet, as a professional person, one has to say, just how far can one go not only with strike action as such, but with industrial action of any kind. I do think this is a dilemma. How far can we allow industrial action to affect welfare of patients?
Yes.
On the other hand, if one doesn't take some kind of industrial action in some circumstances, how far can this be used by management to deny our claim?
Yes, I think
this is a very pungent point which has never been satisfactorily answered.
Because in many ways a union like NUPI doesn't feel constrained.
NUPI has no constraints whatsoever. As a matter of fact, just prior to the last winter's industrial action in the health service, Bernard Dix, who is their Assistant General Secretary, there was a sort of a documentary run by the BBC Nationwide programme. And Bernard Dix was asked then about principles and morality, this kind of thing. Mm. And he replied, "When I go to the negotiating table, there are no such things as principles."
Mm. But you think in Cozy...
Now, when one looks at what happened since then,
yeah,
one can quite realise why he said that. Mm. There are no such things as principles. Mm. Now, in an organisation like Cozy, then I think there have to be such things as principles.
In what ways does Cozy then differ from the Royal College, which would say very much make similar kinds of points, wouldn't they?
They would make... Well, can I possibly try and answer it this way? If you take an organisation like NUPI, I would describe them as being very, very left in the political spectrum. The Royal College I would describe as being very, very right in the same spectrum. And the Confederation is in the middle. On the one hand, tending towards NUPI as being a trade union.
Mm.
On the other hand, tending towards the Royal College as being a professional body.
And do you think the fact that it's nurses...
Now, surprisingly enough, I was talking to Albert Spanswick, the General Secretary, at our Brighton conference 2-3 years ago.
Mm.
3 years, 76, so the long hot summer. Well, not as long as some people think, but it was very hot. And I was suggesting to Albert then that one of the best things the Confederation could possibly do would be to have some form of amalgamation with the Royal College, which would strengthen us in numbers, but also strengthen us on the professional side. Because, to my mind, the Confederation at the moment is tending more to the trade union activities rather than to its professional ideals. In other words, there's a very grave danger, as I think that can be proved by Cherry Knoll history, that where the trade union is too strong, you tend to have employees who are possibly not doing their job as they ought to do it. You see, when NUPI first started here, they were jumping on everything they could possibly lay hands on. They were turning up every stone to find out what was wrong, or what they thought was wrong. And they were trying to tell everybody, and they're still trying to tell everybody what they should be doing. They're assuming that what NUPI says is 100% right, and everybody else is 100% wrong.
So
a lot of people, of course, saw what was going on, and they joined NUPI. Because they say NUPI is the organisation that will fight for the worker. Irrespective of the fact that what NUPI was doing really was undermining all management. Now, when I say management, I also include charge nurses, because charge nurses are management. You see, I'm sure that NUPI is still working on the old class war. That is, well, to try and put it as briefly as possible, they have the Marxian beliefs that the things for the working man become worse and worse until he reaches such a point that he not only goes on strike, but he's actually working for a revolution.
Is that fair to say that all Nupi are on that extreme, though?
Not all of them. I'm convinced in my own mind that there are people in the Nupi organisation who are very, very left, more left than the Marxists even, than the communists, I should say. I do know that they originally appointed Miss Sue Shipman as an area officer. Now, Sue Shipman was a past president of the National Union of Students, which, as you know, is becoming very left these days. She didn't complete her 2 years term. That maybe she was embarrassed to be 29-year-old and still being classed as president of the National Union of Students. So she left the presidency and, as I say, has been appointed as an area officer of NUPI. Now, Sue Shipman is on the executive committee of the Communist Party. Now, this, of course, doesn't prevent her from being a member of NUPI or employed by NUPI. That's NUPI's business. But you have a person who's a member of the Communist Party, who are usually very dedicated people to achieving what they may call alternative society or a different society. I mean, this goes without saying. They state this quite openly. Now, we know Tony Benn, who is on the left, not a communist, not a Marxist, just, I think, a very much misunderstood man. You know, I don't think he's even understood by Tony Benn. Now, he talks about the alternative society. What they mean by that, I'm not terribly sure. But if you have the Communist Party and the International Socialists, or the Socialist Workers, as they're now called, plus all these other fringe groups, sometimes erring on the lunatic side, who are working actively towards overthrowing the present system of government, by which I mean a system of government which has alternatively a Labour Party, a Conservative Party, maybe with two or three terms of office, but the pendulum goes back again and the other party is in power. But you have alternatively Labour and Conservative. Well, they class that as being a capitalist system, that there's no room for anything else. So they try to want to upset this, but they know that if they take part in the system, by which I mean they stand up as candidates to go into Parliament, invariably, not only are they not elected, they lose their deposits, and it's cost them an awful lot of money.
Does that...
One can only remember one communist who's been in Parliament, and that was many, many years ago, Willie Gallagher. I don't think there's been another member of the Communist Party in Parliament since then. So, if they want to overturn government, to have a new system of government, to have a new economic system, there are only two ways in this country whereby you can do that. One is by the bullet, and the other is by the ballot. Now, if they can't get their system of government by the ballot, which obviously they can't do, because nobody votes for them, except perhaps possibly the uncles and grandmothers and what have you, then all you're left with is the bullet, by which I mean some kind of violence, some kind of disturbance in society, by which they can achieve their ends. Now, I'm sure that they work to their ends by virtue of the apathy that exists in every union, unless something comes which affects them directly.
But you said that they were stirring the members up rather than working with apathy. And
no, they will stir their members up at particular times, such as when a big national pay dispute comes. Apart from that, they have the means to stir members up in different localities over local issues.
And you think this is what occurred in Tanupi?
I'm sure that this is what is happening. I know for certain facts. I could give you examples if I had time to think about it at the moment, but I just don't have it at the moment, whereby they've had disputes that could well have been settled by goodwill among both sides.
Do they partly represent a different grade of staff, though, that maybe isn't, not that you mentioned the charge nurse thing?
NUPI represents, well, put it this way, NUPI will take no membership, almost anyone who wants to apply for membership. They have members in the health service, but the bulk of their members, of course, are outside the health service, in parks and gardens, schools, meals, ladies, dustbin men, all that kind of thing. They have 700,000 members, many, many of them part-time people.
But in this hospital, what kinds of, do you think they perhaps attend the charge nurses and...
Oh, they have all grades of staff.
They have
all grades of staff, yes, yeah. Yes.
So it isn't just the sort of, the charge nurses are sort of in Cosy and perhaps the nursing assistants?
No. So right across the board, all grades of staff they have as members.
But you feel that those that are in it are those that want to perhaps stir up? Are they perhaps a younger element of staff that's perhaps a bit more hot-headed or something like this?
No, it is the officials themselves.